Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and perhaps I could begin by asking you to give your name, and then we could begin to talk about your work life, which wasn't directly in the grain trade. But anyway, first of all, you are.
John Winslow.
And you began your employment in the transportation industry.
June 8th, 1978, I started with CN Rail.
So on your 20th birthday? Yeah, because you'd given me that information, so I'm just struck by the June 8th.
Well, it was June 1st that I graduated, and that was my seniority date, but my first shift was June 8th, a midnight shift at Thunder Bay North.
Right, birthday cake had been put away and off you went to work.
Yeah.
And so you began working for the CNR,
Yes.
and you worked for CNR through your
Entire career, I
career.
started out as a switchman brakeman, and then made my way. After 2 years, I wrote the A book and became a yard foreman conductor. And then a year later, I went to Gimli to the technical training school and became a locomotive engineer. And I'd flop back and forth from all three jobs as seniority permitted.
Right. So you became you moved to into what was going to be employment in the running trades, or was from the outset that was there any factor in making that decision, any advantage you had that allowed you to do that, or your family in the trade?
I just finished school and I'd worked construction trades and got laid off around December. And my mother said to me, "There's an ad in the paper, the railway's looking for employees."
In 1978,
Well, 1977, actually.
when you applied,
Yes.
yes. Had your family been in the railway involved?
No.
No.
I had a grandfather that was a telegrapher for the CPR, but I never even met him.
No.
He was dead
Right.
before I was born.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So you've sketched the. So what was involved in becoming a railwayman? Working in the
Well, you went through an interview process and then a medical, and then you went through a training school they had here. They had it was run by Roy Sturt, Blake Kempton, and Jim Ward, and it was 8 weeks long. And you learned all the different things in the Uniform Code of Operating Rules and stories and what to expect. And you went out on tours of the yard and that. And then you actually spent a half a day with a switch crew, the whole class, riding cars and whatever, getting used to the idea of what they had to do and everything else like that.
Right. The switch crew work is on the ground, although I guess you had little,
Yeah, you started on the ground,
right?
and because you were the junior man and you didn't think much, you ran everywhere because you had to catch up to your mistakes. When you got a little more seasoned, after about 30 or 40 shifts, then they'd even use you as a field man, which meant you'd be down at the bottom of the yard making cuts for like pulling pins and tying down tracks and everything else, and the junior man be up at the top end running the switches, and foreman would be releasing the cars according to the switch list. And
This is a making up and breaking down trains, I suppose, is
yes,
it?
yeah,
Right.
and transferring grain trains that came in and into from Nebene to either the Mission or Thunder Bay North or even Current River. And then actually, on certain jobs, you spotted the elevators. And there was some work at Great Lakes and the paper mill at the paper sheds and the craft.
The grain trade made up the larger part of the freight you were moving, though, I
At that
suppose.
time, yes.
Right.
Like 78, and that was really good years for grain.
Right.
And an example was I got a broken wrist in 83 from a motorcycle accident. I came back to work in the middle of May in 84, and I made $100,000 in 1984.
The remainder of the year.
Yeah.
It was probably the heyday of the trade, actually. I'm not sure that 84 itself.
84 was a record year, and there was one day we like, all the elevators in Thunder Bay dumped 5,000 grain cars in one 24-hour period, which meant there were 50 trains between the CN and CP that went out of here.
Wow. Because that was the sort of the rough relationship, 100 cars, did you say, per train?
Yeah, roughly then. And as the power, the motive power became bigger, and the trains expanded, and now an empty train can be, you know, 12,000, 13,000 feet.
Yes.
Yeah, and there was the switch, so too, from...
2.5 miles.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there was the switch from boxcars to all hoppers.
When you were beginning work in 1978, what was the, could you suggest what the proportion was?
50-50.
50-50, the old boxcars.
Yeah, and a lot of the elevators still had the dumpers, like the rocking dumpers for dumping them, and then pretty soon it was only one elevator had one track, and then it disappeared altogether. And with that, they got rid of the AB and the ABD braking systems, which let them run longer trains, like the ABDW brake system.
Oh, yeah.
It was a more reliable brake system. It released better and everything else. And then they went from cast shoes to fiber shoes, brake shoes, so they didn't have to change them as often. And
every dollar saved in maintenance is a dollar for the shareholders.
You know, and like when I first started running trains, like as an engineer from the Technical Institute at Gimli, power braking was the norm. So you'd be pulling and setting the air brakes on your entire train. Near the end, it was all dynamic braking and setting the air, and fuel conservation was a big thing because fuel was expensive.
Sure.
And, like, I mean, generally you'd use about 450 gallons a unit coming from Atikokan to here. And, you know, things got to the point that they ran through Atikokan, and we'd be running to Fort Francis, and we still... the only subdivision with extended runs. They've done away with most of them because it was too long on the road. You know, the trains had to be ready. They had to have the air tests all done, the power on them, and basically you were supposed to get on them and go.
Sure.
But that was the plan, and it never really worked out that way, and they had trouble scheduling, although they bragged that they could run a scheduled railway. But it was pretty tough, you know. And
you were talking about the length of the trains and the routes run. Was your work as an engineer primarily within the city as far as Atikokan or trains, or
it was Atikokan, and then you'd go the north line up to Sulaco,
Superior Junction line.
Yeah,
right.
And that got taken out. I was fortunate enough to get work there taking it out. But it was, used to go 6:45 in the morning, the ore train. And you'd get up there and you'd have about 2 hours off, and then you'd double back. And it was a grind. It was about a 19-hour trip.
Oh, wow.
But it paid pretty good.
This is the road to Atikokan?
To Sulaco.
To Sulaco.
Yeah.
You said ore, right? Carrying...
Yeah. From going up to the mines at Kalin and...
Oh, they were iron.
Yeah, iron ore.
We get iron ore from up there.
Yeah, and Atikokan, we used to get iron.
Soon after you began employment. So you were moving freight trains.
Basically.
Yeah.
And the odd coal train, that started in 78 at first.
The train's coming in from Saskatchewan,
Coal Valley, wherever that is, Alberta, I guess.
Or even further west.
Yeah, and they were going down to the terminal on McKellar Island.
Right.
Getting dumped there.
Your reference to 19 hours suggests that this might be a typical day question. What would a typical day be like?
Oh, in the yard, it was great. You know, you'd come to work, say, for 7:30, and you'd be home by 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Because the grain cars were all in the elevators, I suppose.
Yeah, you'd work contract work. Like, the yard master'd come down, and he'd give you your lists and say, you know, when you guys finish that, you can go. So you used to run around like a mad fool, and you'd take a 10-minute later on, and you'd go home early. They called it the quit system. But the idea was that they could run one locomotive and actually cover almost 4 shifts with it.
Oh, yeah.
And so they had time in between to service them, and there wasn't enough yard power. So
there weren't enough locomotives.
They
were running on a lead system.
Yeah, and so it worked out really well. Like, you'd be able to get home and have a few hours sleep or whatever, and, you know, double or whatever.
Within the usual work day.
Yeah.
You did run an evening shift as well, I don't
know. Oh, yeah, evenings, midnights, all around the clock.
Right. But not within the same day.
Some guys ran. The best one was Tommy McCullough. He ran 10 shifts in a row. So that was, 3 and a third days. I went up on the ore dock one time dumping potash, and we went up on a Monday morning, and we came down on a Thursday afternoon. And Kornacek was the engineer, John. He got his wife to go get us clothes and everything, and they were supplying us with food. You know, he'd have to spot up the cars, and then right. They'd start dumping them over the hole, and because they were using hopper cars, and they were set up for the short axle 3-4-4 iron ore cars, you'd have to move them like half a car length. And then they'd have to dump the hopper and then move them again. But in between, you were waiting for 30, 40 minutes sometimes.
Hardly a night's sleep, though.
Yeah.
Well, up there around the clock through most of that week because trains were coming in.
Well, they were short of guys. Yeah, and, you know, they were pre-filling the pockets because then the boat come in and they just lower the thing and dump, you know, it'd be like 6 cars.
There's more expense keeping a boat waiting than there is in
Well,
in
there
the
is, you know, and like they were actually going to put a roof over that ore dock in 1 year.
Were they?
That the business was that high on potash, but they never did. So now that's the superstore parking lot is the hill yard.
Yes, well, the track's been torn out and
but
a link with the past is gone.
Yeah.
Or very largely gone.
Yeah. The ore dock still stands.
The ore dock is still down there. That's right. I guess one could lay a new rail line as required.
The trestle's gone and everything.
Yeah. They'd have to clear the ground, I guess.
Yeah.
So that would be one kind of typical day.
That wouldn't be typical, but during the summer, it was booming. The grain business was heavy, and there wasn't enough employees. You know, like it was kind of like a joke. Like, out of the classes were 30 people, and you know, like some would move away, some would quit. Like, it's not a job if you were thin-skinned. It wasn't a good job for you. If you had a little bit of self-confidence problems, this job was just terrible. And it's funny, but, you know, it's sad in a way, but in a week, there was a decision made on you. You were either a good worker or a poor one. And if you were a poor one, everybody'd drive you off the job. They'd just make life so miserable for you, you'd say to hell with it and go.
Yeah.
Because your mistakes and everything is costing time for guys in the yard.
Sure.
And that's cutting back on their quit.
Yeah. And this is at the beginning when you're getting started.
Yeah.
And that's the...
Yeah, and that kept up till about... Filtering out of the system. 1985 or so, and then they came with this idea that the same, but the accident rate dropped quite a bit.
I see.
There were a lot of risky things taking place and side swipes, and there, most of the hopper cars you could watch, there was a little line all the way down them where they would touch against another car because it wasn't quite in the clear or whatever. So, the railway was the one place where you could do $1 million damage one day and know you could come to work tomorrow because you still had your job.
Well, I dare say that's true. I worked as a truck driver briefly and cost the company a certain amount of money, but I never managed anything like $1 million for the damage.
The thing is, the equipment's so big and everything, every accident you have is almost spectacular.
Yes.
There's no such thing as just a little thing. Like, a set of wheels off, they didn't even hardly bother. Pretty soon you learned how to pull a car on by yourself so that you didn't have to report it. And the idea why it was there, so they'd check it out, send it back into operation.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're describing the need for a thick skin, it's not so individual harassment that you're alluding to. It's just simply the pressures of the whole system.
Were there
the others as well?
It's harassment. It was pretty funny that some of the old time switchmen would not give you a list. Okay, they had three copies of their list that showed what work, like what car was going where, but they wouldn't give you a list, and they'd start giving you all these different signs arms like. Three slaps on the bum, that's cut three cars off and bring it clear of this track and everything else. And you were trying to learn the lingo, but you were for me, I had never been on the railroad. Most people hadn't.
No.
And then they'd say, are you stupid? Well.
And what about the management of the operation?
Oh, the management,
the foreman. Should have been intervening to prevent this kind of waste of time going on. These guys are playing games with you.
The foreman is the guy that was doing the signals to you.
Where are the supervisors?
It was unbelievable. You got your work. As long as you did your work, showed up on time, went home, you would never see the actual management. Foreman, it was a small crew, eh? There'd be an engineer, and in the winter there might be a fireman, because they would cut back far enough, and there'd be a head-end man, which was the junior guy of the crew, there'd be the field man, which was the senior switchman, and then there'd be the foreman, who was usually senior to all those guys. And you worked together.
Perfectly.
Yeah, right. And you'd get the odd... shift with them, the one guy would be going to a funeral and be booked off, and you'd be set to these guys, and it was almost like a ballet. They knew what they were doing and you didn't.
Sure.
When you first started, you learned a few tracks, you learned where you got the locomotives off the shop tracks, you learned where you parked for lunch, you learned how to get from one yard to the other, and then you started to learn individual tracks. And at night, everything looks different.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah, at night, the tracks all move. But you went along, and, in 6 months or so, you had a pretty good grasp of what was going on.
So what you're describing is that learning phase.
It was pretty intense for a while.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And, the thing is, you had to be very careful, because I've seen guys get killed.
Sure you
have. Lose a leg or whatever, and but it could be.
Yes.
You know.
So how long did you spend on the ground, did you say?
Oh, well, pretty well off and on. From about 1984 on, I was set up as an engineer most of the year.
Right.
You know, and then...
So you survived 6 years of
work on the ground. Being on the ground and, you know, a junior foreman, you always get junior men.
Yes.
You know, and you wouldn't want to put them with senior men during the day when they could be watched. It's the junior guy on midnights with the junior men. And then the junior hog at too, eh? Yeah. So everything's kind of going against you.
Was there any... Did you get any sense that the you know, senior management appreciated these challenges, or was it just such a large organization that it had been done this way all along, and the guys who could do it survived, and the others were gone? They were just got rid of, and people.
Well, after a Wolfland kind of thing, yeah. and you got a little more respect.
They look out for each other.
Yeah,
a little more than earlier.
Yeah, and. And upper management, like, they were always nice to you and everything, except when you were in there because the action was just too big.
Did you have any of those?
Oh, I had a couple, but the one that I remember the best was told by a great storyteller.
Someone else's action.
Harry Totterash. They were at Great Lakes, and there was the core hole where the paper cores went down. And it was actually below the paper shed, so it was quite a steep track. So anyway, rather than go up in the yard and run around these six cars, they all decide they're going to do a drop, which is cut the locomotive off, go past the switch, line the switch, and then roll the cars down this track and then stop them. And they each had a back-to-back brake, like each car had the brakes, and then somebody says, we're stalling, you better take them off. So they all kicked off all six brakes at once, and they were gone. And so anyway, there was a thundering crash at the bottom of the yard at the core hole. They come out, and they're looking, and here's one half-ton squash flat. And Harry's thinking, well, that's not that bad. And then a guy comes out, holy shit, there's three others behind the first one.
So the cars had run off the track into the parking lot.
Well, they ran into where the Great Lakes had parked some work trucks, eh, and took them out. And so then, anyway, Harry says, the worst part was having to promise to Harry Borland that I would never drop a car again at Great Lakes as long as I lived.
Just off the premise.
Eh? Yeah.
Work in other areas.
No, he says, you know, like he says, run around them, but... You know, but, I think that cost Harry 10 demerits. Yeah, but or the time to burn.
Did any of the acid escape?
Oh, we were in the national news. It was hanging over the expressway. They had to close off the expressway. It was dripping. There's still some spots that never have snow down that way. It was a solid acid train going by, and the guys went in for coffee and knocked the handbrakes off and left a single 4400 charging the brake line. And the brake on it, I guess as they released, they came forward and hit it. And it didn't have enough power to stop them, so it just slid it all the way down the yard. And then it hit the derail. And then it come back on the tracks after it had bounced along the ties. And just as it came back on the tracks, there was a solid acid train going from Thunder Bay North heading west, and they smacked them right in the middle. There was cars going every which heckler, and it wasn't odd to hear about cars in the lake, you know, at the end of elevator tracks, because somebody lost count. Because when they come out with hoppers, it was two hoppers were the same length as three boxcars, and they'd be all mixed, counting them through, and you'd have to remember to keep that count.
Yeah, two for three or three for two. That's going to be bad.
And yeah, it is. You know, the one that I remember was they couldn't get a ship into. Well, I remember a lot, but they couldn't get a ship into Current River there at. What's the name of it? United Grain Growers.
UGGs.
Yeah. So anyway, they sent a diver down to hook up to this car to get it out of there. And he says, which one do you want? And they said, what do you mean? Well, there's six of them down there. But shove a couple cars back, and they'd stay for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks at the elevator. They'd never get to the dumper when you come back in and shove back in. So they had no clue where they were. There was a ZZ file at work, had a whole list of track cars, and it was the ones that they didn't know where they were. And you heard about the odd hopper, it wouldn't sink, so the Coast Guard would lasso it and bring it over to Kiefer and tie it up there.
It's great stuff to remember. Oh. And at the time, I suppose, too, these were stories that were shared over a coffee, lunch, or whatever.
Oh, yeah. You should interview Harry Totterash. He can tell you stories that will leave you just in stitches. Yeah. He's a great storyteller. I mean, we used to bring a lot of logs in from Graham for Great Lakes.
Sure.
And there was an odd train that was pretty big come in.
Yeah. So that was one of the changes that occurred over the years.
Yeah, they went to chipping at the...
Yeah. Change in the industries that you were dealing with. You mentioned changes in the cars, yeah. Of course.
Well, the worst
grade trade.
The worst.
I'm going to start to record there. There's a bit of a delay in it starting up afterwards.
We were on.
Well, the biggest change here was when they made grain not have to go through a port of export. Before, they used to have to bring all the grain in here and it would get weighed and graded, and then it would be sent out. So even if the grain was going across the border, it was coming in here.
U.S.
Or
anywhere
else.
Or wherever.
Yeah. But it had to either come here, or Vancouver, or Rupert, or I think it was Montreal.
Right.
And once they changed that to where the farmer could ship direct from the country elevator, and a lot of elevators then put in dryers,
right,
which they didn't have before.
Well, those big throughput elevators were built on the prairies. And
yeah, they went to the, like, they called them the Buffalo elevator, like where they'd do away with 10 or 15 small ones and build one big central one.
Yes.
You know, and they get better freight rates because they could take 100 cars at a time rather than 10 and 20.
Because that was one of the changes that reduce the amount of grain moved through the lakehead, I suppose, as you're suggesting.
It changed it a lot.
There were others as well, I suppose.
The Pacific Rim taking more grain than Europe, you know, and the cash flow troubles with Russia, and, you know, it was, and then all of a sudden, Argentina's exporting grain, and even China's got a surplus, and, you know, it became a world agricultural thing too.
You became, you
know, Australia exporting grain.
Yes, well, Australia had been a major exporter over the years. Saudi Arabia's production of wheat, of course, around somewhere through the 80s, using that oil money that they had to launch irrigation schemes. And when you think of Saudi Arabia with a wheat surplus, some ridiculous things are happening.
Yeah, and you know, then the switch out of coal, like that's pretty big business. Like Ontario Hydro bought them, I don't know, about 12 or 14 sets of coal trains, complete with locomotives.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The whole unit train was,
it was
or
theirs,
a number of
actually,
unit trains.
But they, like, I mean, the locomotives became property of CN, but CN had to promise to keep three locomotives on. At when it first started, it was four. You know, they were really overpowered. And then, too, containerization started.
Yes.
And all that stuff moved on the main line because it was lightweight and it had to go fast. And, you know, just-in-time delivery became a big thing. One time, Neebing Yard looked like a rolling paper storage for Great Lakes. Like, I think there was once we had about 480 cars of paper that hadn't been billed to go anywhere because they had run it on spec because they knew that Detroit Free Press uses so many tons, So they didn't have anything going on. They'd run that paper and load it up so that when they got the call, they'd just say, okay, this car is going to Detroit or whatever.
Jeez. Or I'll give you three taps on the top of your head or something. Eh?
Okay, I'll let you know when you're okay.
So there were all kinds of changes taking place over the years in the
And going freight to the end train unit instead of the caboose. That was a
right another late '80s.
Yeah, that was another.
Yeah, Angus and I fought that in Parliament for a while.
Yeah,
when it was coming in. How many workers? I was going to say men, and I guess men would be fair enough. Was the workforce entirely male in the running trades?
Pretty well. Like, yeah. I mean, there was the odd female. That started about 74 here in the Lakehead. Maybe a little earlier in other terminals, but not much. Yeah. The females that were employed were usually clerks.
Right, in the office.
Yeah.
As far as the trades were concerned. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, men, and then we have this clarified. How many men would there be on a trade, say, Atacocca to here or Sioux Lookout?
Well,
back and forth.
Originally there was four, unless there was a fireman, that would make five. Yeah. And the two on the tail end, a conductor and tail end brakeman, and then the head end brakeman and engineer, and sometimes a fireman.
Now, what would the fireman be doing by this time? This was the old feather bedding thing when the steam locomotives went and the diesel came in.
Well, that's the thing. They were guaranteed jobs up to... I think the cutoff date was 1968. I think that was the cutoff date when they started the engine service brakeman program, which is what I went through.
Okay.
And they called us piglets. We weren't full-fledged hoggers. We were piglets trying to get at the trough. But it guaranteed them that they'd be cut back. They would be firemen. One time it was kind of a thing that they drew a line and said, this will be the junior engineer. And you had to bump all over the district. As long as you could hold a job, you couldn't be a fireman. So they spent a lot of time out on the road. And I remember a story Leonard Delvecchio telling me. He says, I'm the junior guy, and he says, I bump into... Gillum, he says, you know, and making the run into Churchill.
Yeah, Gillum had better told
me. Yeah, and yeah. He says, I get up there, it's the only place that still had a stoker, a hand bomber. He says, the engineer says to me, he says, I want to see this steam gauge on my side, which is the high side of the needle, eh? So he says, and we start, and I'm shoveling and shoveling and shoveling, and he says, I haven't done this for like 5 years. Like, everything's twin self-stokers or bunker C. And I'm working and working and working. Finally, I said to him, if you want to see it pointing to you, you got to come to this side of the cab. He says, we get up there, and it's like my back is seized. I have to have help getting off the locomotive. He says, I come in the bunkhouse. He says, I pour a hot bath and I just sort of roll trying to get my back muscles to relax. He says, shoveled about 23 tons of coal and I hadn't shoveled for about 5 years. He said,
I guess those are the some of the human dimensions of shifting from steam locomotives to diesel. I suppose it was easier work for for the running guys.
Yeah,
certainly for the firemen.
Yeah, well, you know, like all the old-time guys that did work on steam all had glasses because they were staring into a red, white-hot flame.
Sunglasses.
And no, they all had glasses because they had damaged their vision, burnt out some of their eyesight.
Yeah, some of the red. Well, they should have been wearing sunglasses.
Well, I don't know what they should have been wearing, but... You know, at the time, it wasn't...
People didn't think about
it. Yeah, no. You know, and it just wasn't. And I've heard of guys becoming, having to retire because of the coal dust getting to them and
sure
everything else. Yes. And, you know.
That takes you back, takes us back before your time.
Yeah, but, that's but just stories I heard at the the lunch table in Atacocan. And guys so, would talk about it, and you'd sit there and just be amazed. It was great.
Yes, I could imagine.
You know,
in fact, there is a life of storytelling and sharing experiences and so on.
That's
one upping others and so on. That is a good. There must be a good deal of that in the running trades.
Yeah, but you got a lot of good information from these stories too. You learned
morals being offered.
Well, no, but there was some of that. I remember. I was working into Boston Bar out of Kamloops one winter when I was cut off here. I went to Kamloops, and they had a beanery, which was a place that they paid to stay open to serve meals 24 hours a day. And I was in there having breakfast, and there was four or five crews of us having breakfast. And the one young guy says to the other guy, he says, "Well, who did you use as a lawyer when you got divorced?" "Oh," he says, "I use so-and-so, but he's not very good." He says, "Cost me almost everything." So he says, "Well, ask Stoliker. He can tell you." So, "Donnie, who's the best divorce lawyer around?" He says, "This guy." "Well," he says, "he should know. He's been divorced 3 times.
Well, there's information to be shared.
Yeah,
all right.
The marriages were stressed to the limit because the wife became the main focal point of your family when you were on the road. She was the one that made sure the kids got to the dentist, to the doctors, and, you know, had their parties or whatever, and sure, play times, and it put a lot of stress on her. Like, the hardest working person in a railway is the wife.
In a railway family.
Yeah, and yeah. If you go to retirement due, that's the first person that all the people thank that are retiring.
For sticking with them through all those years. Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. On the road.
Like if you were working on the road, like in freight service, through freight, you were never sure when you were going to be home. And when you left, you weren't sure if you were going to be back in 24 hours or sometimes, you know, 3 days.
Or be brought in.
Well, yeah, a lot of turns out of Atacocan to Huronian because of the grade. So you'd take a small heavy train and run it up to Huronia and put it in sidings there.
Right.
And then you'd run back to Atacocan with just the engine and caboose. And the next guy coming with a train would come up to Huronia, and because it was all downhill from there, he'd hook onto your train, combine them, and come into the lakehead, eh? But
yeah.
I was lucky. There wasn't much of that going on when I started. It was mostly everybody got through.
So from 78 through into the 80s, you became an engineer.
Yeah, in 81.
You
was were still put on the seniority list.
And you were still running with four, I guess for half a dozen years or a little bit more, there were before the four of you on the train. And then is it around 89 that the caboose disappears, or is it even earlier than that?
It's about then. Like, I mean, but there was the crew, and you had to fill up all the road crews, and if you didn't, and it went to the closing period of the bulletin, which was 14 days, it became a reduced crew. And they gave out handshakes from this reduced crew, the money they saved from the fourth guy that they didn't have. They would retire more people so they could reduce them again more faster. And pretty well everybody was running with just a three-man crew. A conductor at the tail end, a brakeman up at the head end, and an engineer.
And the engineer.
Yeah, and then the next thing they came out with was the end-of-train unit. And
right.
Done away with the caboose.
I have a memory of the railways, CN in particular, reducing its workforce in the late 70s, about the time that you began. Am I wrong?
No, there was big reductions. Like, you got to remember, rails were 39 feet. And there'd be 7 or 8 guys with tongs hooking onto it to put it in place. Eh?
Right.
All of a sudden, the rails became quarter mile. And, you know, and they'd done away with all the lanterns that were on switch stands. And the guy that used to fill them and maintain them, he was gone. And
So it's mechanization of the, what's the term for the maintenance crews and so on and so forth, yeah, the section and, gangs and all of that.
Like is even it, is green that doors, really... you know, like once they came out with the hoppers, they didn't need the green door guys anymore.
No.
And there was the coopers that repaired the green doors and the guys that used to pull them. And
so it's largely technological change that leads to these reductions, then, is it, in the late
A lot of that, and a lot of the fact that the railway changed their attitude. Like at one time, it didn't matter how bad the snowstorm was, the railway ran. Sure. But nowadays, we're just as vulnerable as everybody else. If they get a lot of snow, we're not going anywhere. But they don't have the manpower, eh? All the switches get snowed in, and like they've tried blowers and heaters, and they have a jet engine, and they melt the snow down the track, and that's what they use.
I see. That's the supposed way to go in a way. It isn't cheap, I suppose. You need a lot of fuel, but it'll do the job, I'm sure.
Yeah, it gets rid of a lot of work.
I'm wondering whether, as a Canadian historian, I might speculate that a railway, the CNR, would have seen itself as offering a national service in which the service was more important than the profitability of the operation. Am I right?
Well, when I first started, it was the boxcar said, serves all Canada. Do you remember that? Maple Leaf with that logo in it?
Oh, yes.
And once the rail abandonment process started, they couldn't shed enough. And then it became almost a semi-private organization, the Crown Corporation that had to stand on its own 2 feet kind of thing.
Right.
And so getting rid of unprofitable lines was a big thing. Property, and then all of a sudden there was some big fights over property taxes. I know the taxes in Toronto were to go from $5 million to $85 million a year. The unions helped the company on that part and fought it. And actually the unions turned it around.
Did they?
For the companies, yeah.
Because you need those votes, in a sense, in the community
and the fact
to do the
that
job.
They, you know, like, I mean, when I started, it was the United Transportation Union represented the running trades, but not the engineers. The BLE, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, was still a union. And we actually had deputizations in Parliament and in the Senate. Like, they were quite interested. We got involved in a big study of circadian. We were in that big time.
Did it produce any
It reduced our hours.
Yes.
You know, and made life a little...
reduced the patterns of shifts that you were into? Because that would be even more important than reducing hours. It'd be the shifts.
Well, it was still hard with the shifts, but some of the road terminals where it was really busy divided the clock into three parts. And if you were on, there'd be, for example, the Morning Glories, the Cardinals in the afternoon and the Owls at night. And if you weren't called in that period, you knew you weren't going to get called again till the next
24 hours later.
Well, 15 hours or whatever.
Later. Right.
So that you could know that you didn't have to keep trying to nap, because lots of times a train would be on the lineup, like out of Winnipeg, and they'd steal the power off it because it was a grain train and it wasn't really that. They needed the motive power on some other high-speed train or something.
Yes.
And it would fall by the wayside, and so you'd be napping and trying to stay well-rested and try to lead a normal life. And
Well, circadian rhythm certainly would play into that, because if you are living with that kind of uncertainty, you can't get a decent rest, whereas if you knew you had 15 hours, you could get 8 or 10 in there.
Well, you know, you can have some time with your family.
And that, of course, as well, yes.
So it helped change our lifestyle quite a bit.
Did the Brotherhood of Railway, of Locomotive Engineers, continue all the way through your employment?
Well,
when did you retire?
I haven't retired.
Oh, you're...
No, I'm off sick with a heart condition, but...
And you're expecting to overcome it, or...
I think I will.
I see.
It was an irregular heartbeat. I got cardioversion, and it's back to regular, and now...
Okay. Yeah, because you began employment 31.
Yes, I am. You know, but... what was the question?
The question was about the Brotherhood. Is it still in existence?
It was up till 7 years ago.
I see.
And then we voted and became, we're still the Locomotive Engineers, but we're tied into
not UTU, I take it.
No, we're tied into the Teamsters. We're the rail conference of the Teamsters Union.
I'll be darned. Across the continent? Or this is
in Canada. All Canada, the engineers, both CPNCN, went to the Teamsters. And
why
the
would
joke
you have
was,
done that?
Well, we're getting too small, our union. And
but why not join the UTU?
The UTU. What can I see overcome?
Yeah.
It's just like Thunder Bay. Everybody still talks about the South Core, the North Core, Current River, West Fork. Well, you know, it was the same there. Like, there's a lot of distrust. A lot of it happened because some of the seniority was robbed from engineers by the UTU. Like, they said that everybody would have an 82 date as a conductor. And so guys that had started in the 60s all of a sudden went from a 60 date to an 82 in as a conductor. And one thing you do not touch is seniority. Seniority is sacrosanct in the railway business. Yeah. Like, we have made exceptions and accommodations where a guy would be junior man and he'd bump guys that were senior to him to stay at because he needed an accommodation to work till his seniority finally caught up to him.
And this was accepted?
There were a couple cases. There was a dairy case, and that went to the labor board, where the labor board just said, well, we'll manage your seniority system. This guy's got this date right here. And we didn't want to go to that to find out how bad we could defend ourselves or maybe not.
Yes.
So we made accommodations, and like I say, there were some sour grapes, but on the whole, it kept our seniority intact the way it had been all the time.
The Brotherhood was very important to you,
the
Rail Conference now.
Yes, and the UTU was only on the CN. The CPR went to the Teamsters, and the CN was still on the UTU, and they finally went 2 years ago and joined us on the Teamsters.
I see. So all the running trades are Teamsters now.
Yeah. See, the joke is, if you mess with us, we just call Chicago in.
Right. Well, becoming
Giant
part of the
Stadium or something.
Becoming part of the Teamsters Union does open you to all kinds of observations, good and otherwise. I can appreciate. But
so we still have some autonomy. Like, they left our constitution, and they left our way of running things where we have, like, locals. Like, they left that in, whereas they don't have that. They have big, big locals. Like, there's one that represents all across Canada, the dairy workers that are in the Teamsters.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And
which makes anything like grassroots democracy practically impossible in a local, in a
well,
size.
Well, you can do stuff in it, but it's that much harder to do the work.
Yes.
You know,
to get to know the people, to organize them. To,
and it's more like when local issues come up, unless they affect us, so.
Whereas when you started, the Brotherhood local here was able to take care of things, I suppose.
Well,
it was
a non-adversal thing. We didn't actually have shop steward. we had a local chairman,
right,
which in a way was a shop steward
for,
I guess,
for everyone.
Yeah, and stuff
in,
like
both
that.
Both of the railways, or
both of the railways. Every local had their local chairman, and then you had a general chairman, which was your division. Like there was the mountain region, the prairie, and then the eastern region.
This is prairie here, I suppose.
Yes, yes, yeah. we're the end of the prairie, and. So it was a different setup, and the Teamsters had a hard time accepting it.
Yeah.
They really did.
Sort of wrapping their minds around.
Well, they like almost controlling their
executive,
and they do control their unions quite a bit.
The Beckett Hoff.
Just amazed that our last four international presidents were impeached in their second term and booted out. Like that, they just couldn't believe that.
Your last four.
Yeah, before we joined them. But
tell me a little bit more about it. All impeached for the same thing, or
no? One was one had come out and said there is no way we're going to deal with the UTU at this time, and he made a big deal of it. He said we tried to talk to them; they just want to take us over. And that's that. And then the next thing we know, we're signed in a tentative agreement with them. Well, that didn't go over too well.
No, I can understand it.
And it's unlike politicians. We hold our guys' feet to the fire when they promise something and don't deliver.
Yeah.
We really do. And we do it right away.
How long is a term? 2 years?
For international, I think it's four.
For the old brotherhood?
Yeah, it was
just to get a re-election, and then goofed up, and then
found themselves under attack. Yeah, there was impeachment proceedings, and they were watched pretty carefully.
And I suppose they were out, and someone else began a 4-year term then, didn't they?
Or the remainder of the term.
Or the remainder of the term was filled by someone else.
The vice president usually moved up, and sometimes he was the guy that started the proceedings.
Well, I suppose, yes.
You know, like once you get high enough in the company and high enough in union stuff, you can't tell the players without a program. Okay? They're all the same. They come from the same mold. They transfer back and forth, even.
Including Paul Tellier?
Paul Tellier was nothing. He was a figurehead. It was his second in command that was the real
boy.
Was
that?
That was the guy from the States. He's the president now. What the hell was his name? But he was the guy that had all the big ideas and big money too.
Yeah. Well, the CN is now as much a U.S. Railway as it is a Canadian, I think.
It's probably
in terms
more
of rail
so.
Of line being run.
I mean, we had a guy up here for a little while that was from Battle Creek in Michigan in the States, and he was wearing a bulletproof vest. And we were at a meeting, and I said to him, I says, you know, you look like an idiot. And he says, what do you mean? I says, you know, you're going to find out about us Canadians, okay? We're hell on wheels with a word processor. When you see letters to the editor, we'll cut you to shreds. But we're not going to shoot you. Don't be silly.
Yeah, no.
But I'll tell you what, if a cop sees you with a bulletproof vest, he's liable to shoot you thinking you're a badass. Normal people don't wear them.
No, they certainly don't. Did he get rid of it then?
Yeah, he finally figured out that. But down there, he was always scared of his life.
Really?
Oh, he cut so bad. And that's one thing that once you became profit-orientated, there was no more nice guy.
No, there certainly wasn't. I don't know. When would you say it? Did it stop within your...
No,
period of
no,
employment?
It's even worse now.
I mean, being a good guy, was that true of the railway when you started in 78, would you say?
But, you know, like they gave you your day's work, eh?
Yeah.
Here, they micromanage you. Like the big terminals have cameras all through the yard, and you're a yard foreman. They tell you, pull out this track and take this car and this car and this car, and then put them into this track, and you do that, and then... You go to the pole and you say, what do you want next? And they say, well, we want you to do this. And they'll have you go back in that same track, you know, like two tracks later and pull out another couple of cars and put them to another track.
Mm.
Think for yourself. if you come to work and take your brain out and put it in your locker and just go around with your head down saying, yes, sir, you survive well. I do feel sorry for new employees. Unless this changes, it's going to be bad.
Did it come out of the U.S.?
A lot of
this style of management.
That is the way they make money. And they perfected it with us. I mean, we were a cash cow like you wouldn't believe. I think most of the teachers' plan bought big time into us. We split shares about 10 times.
What was launched by the privatization of CN has certainly been a capitalist triumph. And, of course, to the advantage of pensions, teachers, and others. I mean, that's the irony of present capitalism in North America.
Well, they say a lot of problems start with that teachers' union. No, because they have so many teachers on the cusp that are going to retire.
Yes.
They won't venture capital into something that might make them money down the road. They want sure things, and they don't do it. And they've caused a lot of companies to collapse because they control so much money.
Yes. Well, we're getting further away from the great trade by the moment, but that's a very interesting observation.
I mean, you know, at one time you could look out in a harbor and you've seen lots of lights. Like I remember 84, you could count 20, 25 ships just waiting to get in. Yes.
It was a great summer to be elected to Parliament.
It probably was. I mean, you know.
Frank Mazur is talking about 1,800 men on the waterfront and in the great trade. Great handlers. And these days, of course, if you've got 250 out there or whatever, it would be.
And most of the elevators have merged together and closed a lot of houses.
Well, I think a typical day is a...
Typical day, you come to work, you know, you go out, you have whatever list you have, and you come back in for coffee as close to the 2-hour mark as you can, and you take your 20 minutes, and nowadays you better be back on that locomotive moving it, and some of them move by remote control.
Yes, I understand that they are all run by human beings, or at least...
That's another thing that is a sore point with a lot of us. In 84, they first automated the yard in the hump yard at Winnipeg. And we voted that it would be a strike. You know, there's no way they're taking that job away from us unless the guy running the controls is an engineer.
Sure.
This is going to be a strike issue, and... our guy dilly-dallied rather than just put it to him like, you better be able to run every train you got by remote control because as of midnight we're out. Yeah. And he didn't do that, and he went to arbitration, and the arbitrator awarded that it was just a different way of sending signals. Much the same way as the poor old telephone operator got replaced by a computer.
Right.
And you're replaced by a computer.
By all of Nortel's marvels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we lost that, and, you know, nowadays they've pretty well...
continued to slide down the slope.
Well, they've had to do away with them because one of the things they had to come up with was guaranteed employment.
Yes.
And so they were paying guys $2,500 a half, like every 2 weeks, to stay at home.
Yeah.
And they realized that this isn't a good deal.
No,
and, you know, when they started it, they always thought it would be the junior employee. Well, if you're a senior guy and you got your house paid off and everything, why do you want to be out in the cold when you can sit at home and collect $2,500?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they found out that it was all the senior men. And everybody was trying to crowd into terminals that had an excess of employees. Kamloops was a prime example. There were guys as far away as bigger Saskatchewan that had Kamloops as their home terminal just because they knew for 8 weeks they weren't going to work, and then they had to work for 2 weeks, and it'd be 8 weeks again before they had to work.
Now, there's a classic negotiating mistake on the part of management to have set that one up.
Well, they had to come through with something.
Yeah.
You know, they were cutting us so bad, and... I went to a meeting in Edmonton where they were explaining, and they said that right today we expect to have 158 guys on the furlough board, and we have 163. And we're happy with that number, you know, and as guys retire, and they got the right size workforce, but they just didn't have the ability to move them around.
No.
And
you can move locomotives by remote control, but
well, no, but
engineers are a bit more difficult.
Well, no, but employees would say no, you know, like, yeah. why would I move over here?
Yes.
And so they had then they retired people, like in Jasper is a prime example. They paid them like $50,000 or $60,000 to sign away their seniority. Then they wanted to hire them back because they had nobody to take their place. And they were paying them $20,000 bonus to hire back.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. Like, I mean, it's what we plan and what happens sometimes are two different things. And now the economy's gone for crap. And
yes.
I can see the day when all you'll see coming in is a road crew into Thunder Bay. And they'll be dropping it off to some Railtex corporation or something to service the elevators. Everybody wants to get out of yard work. Yard work is intensive, and you don't make that much at it. The big bucks is unit trains.
Yeah. Well, the railways have been going at that kind of business for a long time, but they're not interested in passengers,
well,
that's for sure, nor in package freight business. They got right out of that decades ago and so on.
And that's how
these are changes, of course,
out,
in the industry. But
yeah, they're squeezing out the little elevators, and the big farms are squeezing out the little farmers. And
yes,
you know, it's just the way of the world. You got to get bigger to make money. I don't know why, but that seems to be everybody's thought.
The Sprott investment firm in Toronto has teamed up with a bunch of First Nations on the prairies to operate a great agricultural corporation, which will become, if it goes into effect, it will be the largest farm in the West, I'm sure, because only so many of these reserves on the prairies do have farmland. And if this organization runs them, it'll change the balance on the prairies, I would think. But anyway, back to what would you like people to know about the work that you do?
Some of it was really long hours, and some of the conditions outside are terrible. Like, I mean, everybody knows when it's cold and 40 below, you stay in, whereas you have people outside and you take turns coming in to the cab and warming up, but you'd be outside lots, and it was quite challenging work. And generally it got done, and you went home with a good feeling. Like, you knew you spotted that whole elevator, and that grain was going to be going on a boat somewhere to feed people, and you felt like you were doing something positive.
How much would the work fall off at the close of navigation?
Oh, it was like the seniority list caught pneumonia. One day there'd be 50 guys under you, and the next day it would be 30 guys ahead of you were laid off, plus the 50 that were behind you and you. It was very seasonal for CN, and you had the privilege of district seniority. Like, you could move. Like, I spent the winter in Kamloops. I spent two winters in Edmonton.
Because otherwise you were laid off without anybody except UI.
Yes.
I suppose.
And that was easier to collect then.
Yeah, it was, of course.
Than it is today. But the other thing is, like, at the time when I first started, you had to work one day a month to get your pension credits.
Okay.
And now it's a preponderance of hours. Okay, and if you don't have your full, say, 120 hours in that month or whatever, you'll get a proportion of that month. But the big thing was to get that one day a month in.
And in winters, that could be a challenge.
Yeah.
Sometimes. So I was thinking of that. The harshest weather is presumably occurring during the season when
sometimes
the ships
would get lucky. If it was really terrible out, the old guys would stay home, and they couldn't find anybody on the spare board, if they knew you were willing to go to work, sometimes they jump guys just to go to you, because at that time it was local people doing the phoning.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had a crew management system here, and they had the little Lego board, and all the names were on it and phone numbers. And
they knew you.
If they knew that they could get you after about 15 minutes of trying, they'd phone you.
Yeah.
And, you know, to hell with the few runarounds or whatever that come in.
Sure.
Then that became centralized, too.
So you get calls now out of what?
Well, it was Winnipeg, and now it's all Edmonton, does all Western Kent.
Yeah. Electronic communications, marvels.
Yeah.
What might interest or surprise people most about what you've done, or and expect to do again, of course?
I don't know. Hauled big trains, I guess.
Yeah.
Heard people complain about the size of trains and everything. I heard that all through the start of my career. Oh, we're going to have to put in overpasses. They got us blocked. Everybody was working. Now I think they'd like to be blocked.
They wouldn't mind having
yeah.
the trains coming into the elevators, I dare say, yes. In
terms of it's funny. Meant. Sometimes your worst nightmare is your wish come true. Eh?
Yeah, that can certainly be the case. Are you most proud of in the work?
Everybody was. There was a pride. Like, I mean, you didn't go around wearing it on your vest. Like, you're Canadian. Canadians are kind of humble. You know, there were a few guys that went around bragging, you know, that they made all sense of satisfaction.
Yeah. And the locomotive engineers, of course, have been top of the heap of the running trains and have
we always
that feeling.
We've always thought that, but you know, like, it's funny, like, locally you can get along with a lot of people, but when it gets up, like I say, into the national scene and everything else, all of a sudden they can't get along with each other. Mm. And that's funny, because locally we had good rapport with the other unions, and you know,
and with management
yeah
as well, are you suggesting?
Oh yeah, management here was you know, you could go and approach them, and they might come back to you and say, you know, your idea is a crock of shit, but at least they'd listen to you a little bit, and maybe, you know, if you had a good point or two, one or two things might be incorporated.
Right.
You know, they were great that way, because most of the management here was out of the running. He was in the billing department, not.
And then became manager locally? Was he not?
He was never the big manager.
He wasn't.
He was the manager in the administrative part.
Okay.
Okay, but not as far as running trades. Running trades, for a lot of years, were the management of running trades had come from the running trades. So they had a little more sympathy for you sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes they would just listen to you and then give you the little fiddle.
A knowing smile or whatever.
Yeah, but they'd just say, the favorite saying was, you know, it's called lack of seniority, and there's only one cure for that. That's time.
Well, that is a marvelous line.
Yeah.
I don't have to ask you whether you think that your work contributed to Canada's international grain trade. Obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And you were moving the grain.
And you know, the funniest thing was, they had a grain seminar by the Seaway Corporation.
Oh, yes.
And they had invited all the elevators and everything. And one guy phoned me and said, how come you guys aren't in there? So we phoned, and we got invited to the wrap-up. And then all they could talk about was the high cost of
transportation?
No. Of workman's comp.
Workers' comp.
And I said to him, I said, you know what? I said, here's what I'll guarantee you. I'll guarantee you, we throw the system out, and I'll have blood-sucking lawyers up here, and you guys will not be in business in 18 months.
Yeah.
Because I said, you guys get a guy that loses part of an arm? I says, your rates go up 10 cents an hour?
Yeah.
I mean, that's worth $20 million. Yeah. And I says, that's cash that you got to come up with right today.
Yeah.
I said, you guys don't realize, like, I mean, it's good for you. And I said, it's good for some of us. But if you're if you're permanently injured,
that's right.
It's not that good. And yeah. Like, I mean, when it was invented, the workers had nothing and they couldn't afford lawyers and, you know.
Well, I think even then, from the beginning, when who was the judge who offered the report about 1912, I think it was, in Ontario, I think there was a recognition in industry, certainly, that they were going to clear the decks of all the threats of legal action and all of those problems. This would be a system that would provide somewhat for the injured, but it would clear them of all those concerns. And any smart company leader knows that. The fact that these guys were bitching about it, if I may say so, is an indication of how little, a large sense they had of the operation. And you drove that home to them by pointing out the realities.
But I just told them the way it was.
Well, it sounds like a lot of middle management people who don't were at this seminar talking about this because, yeah. I mean, the senior people know better.
But anyway, we're getting off topic.
We are a little off. That strike you as significant changes in your job over the years?
Well, the locomotives are becoming more computerized. Like, there's less and less that you can do with them, and more things that you do on a computer to get them running better.
Are they more fuel efficient as a result, for example?
They are. They are very fuel efficient. They transfer power better to the wheels. You can haul heavier trains. And generally speaking, I think they've gotten as big as they can. The advances they've made on traction motors and independent suspension type things.
Because these locomotives now are run by individual motors at the wheels, I presume.
They've always been run, but usually...
With a generator.
But usually they've been... The first ones were direct current, alternating current with direct current feed at certain speeds and everything else, and it's improved the reliability. Like, I mean, it used to be that you had lots of locomotives, and you had two or three spare ones at every terminal. So if a train come in and had one that went tits up, you were a little while delayed, but you could slap a new locomotive or new consist on and then work on this one and get it going. Now, our locomotive fleet got old. It really got old. Like, I mean, I think the average locomotive for a while at CN was 14 or 15 years old. And that's too bad, but they got old. And some of the stuff that did come in with this new company is, we're going to have new locomotives because they're down less, they run more, they're more fuel efficient. Like, we'll get rid of this scrap, and they got rid of it. But now they've kept the fleet. Well, I guess now it isn't so bad, but they had the fleet solely 2.5 days worth of transportation because they were running them that tight.
Sure.
And
redundancy.
Yeah, and they've gotten that way with the tracks. They bring a big crew in and they fix the track up, and then they figure it should last 10 years or whatever with this weight that goes over it. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, they're band-aiding it, and finally either they get a big derailment or a series of little ones and say, well, it's about time, and they bring that big crew back and, you know, redo the line. And they do away with the regular maintenance a little bit and cut back here and cut back there, and Transport Canada seems to go along with it.
Speaking of people from the industry and the business side of it running things, I suppose.
Most of Transport Canada is upper management from both railways.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that's an old pattern, that regulation, and by the lights that they have of what...
To a certain extent, some of the stuff they've done has been innovative. Very little of it. I mean, let's face it, they're going to the LED lights at crossings because there's 30 light bulbs. So 3 burn out, that's no big deal.
Yeah.
you know, and so they so now bring somebody instead 10 years of hence to, instead of having yeah. weekly inspections of it, it's gone to monthly, you know, and yeah. stuff like that. Like I'm sure that if you ask them dead out, have you tried to risk safety, they'll say no.
Oh, they'll
we're managing the risk in different ways. And some of the things they've done have been good. Some of them have been a crock of shit.
Yes.
And the general public just doesn't seem to care. As long as you don't have a Mississauga or yeah. something.
Well, the general public doesn't think it could have any, so they just don't get stirred up because they figure they're helpless before these huge organizations. If you and the union can't move them, if members of parliament shouting don't make any difference, the ordinary citizen isn't going to have any effect at all.
No.
So they don't even get stirred up.
The worst thing is, like, I mean, you know, all of a sudden the rest clause became important after Hinton.
Yeah.
If Hinton had not occurred...
Which is really to say that yeah. Managing risk means we'll see how close we can cut it, and if it blows up in our faces, we'll change our policies.
Basically.
The car companies that decide they could run a certain cost in the way of lawsuits on a car that wasn't completely
not
safe.
Not the Pinto.
I think I was thinking Ford, wasn't I?
The Fireball. and then he became everybody's idol over at Chrysler.
Right, oh yes.
Yes, it's funny how it goes.
These changes clearly have quite an impact. Keep talking about them for quite a while, I have no doubt. What other challenges did you face over and above the ones that you've mentioned? The shifts, the family challenges, the weather, management, rival unions.
That's, you know, it all is together. I mean, you know, like some of the things have been really good. Like I was fortunate enough, there was another fellow and myself, and the old guard was getting too old, and we had to change it. So we were both thinking of running for the local chairman's job, which is actually where your contractual problems and
where they're confronted.
Yes, and we decided that if we both ran again, we'd just split the vote and the old guy get in. So we flipped the coin. And I lost. Sometimes I think you won the toss.
Well, I was because we'd ask you who was the winner here, the one who got the position or who didn't get
it. On the legislative side, I didn't actually have that much dealing face to face with company people.
No, you wouldn't.
But I did lots to try and improve the health and welfare of all Ontario plus our members.
Sure.
You know, some of the proposals we put forward were actually, you see them today again. Like the Women's Institute at one time put the little dots on the boxcars because of the amount of unprotected crossings at grade in the prairies and the fact that cars were running into them because there was no lights or anything. And then all of a sudden the railways got away from it. Well, we finally got them to where they're having to put reflective material back on cars because there's still unprotected crossings. Sure. There's less of them
yeah.
and there's less trains. But there's still unprotected crossings yeah. and people in a snowstorm and that are running into us.
Or at night.
Yeah. You know, the we're big into the Stop, Look, and Live, Operation Lifesaver. We're also big in the circadian rhythm rest rules. And we've put forward a lot of proposals, like even on highways, to increase the number of passing lanes. Because people get upset and all of a sudden they're taking silly chances. But if you sure. know in 2 kilometers there's going to be a passing lane,
yes,
maybe you don't pull out your nose
no.
on that place that's a little...
Well, the prairies have done the right thing with the 4-lane highways and paved shoulders.
So guys can move over. So that you just yeah.
pull out of the way and let the guy behind you who's yeah. in a rush get by you and then you pull back in.
Yeah, and... No, there's a lot of other things we've tried to do.
Yeah.
And some of them we've been successful, but on the whole, like even a local like ours has generally put about 80 or 90 submissions in every 3 years. We have legislative executive gets together, and if they're similar, they combine them because, sure. Like,
consolidation.
Good idea is a good idea. It doesn't matter if it comes from down east or out in the prairies. Like, I'm the odd duck at those meetings. So's Sioux Lookout, so's Rainy River.
Yeah.
We're actually the only ones that are in a different district as far as our contracts are concerned and everything, yet we're in the Legislative Board of Ontario.
Oh, yes.
So, we've done a lot that way, and now the person that won the local chairman's job, he's Western Canada GC, general chairman. And
is there still a Rainy River local?
Yeah, actually they moved from Rainy River to the fort, and now they're moved back to Rainy River because they abandoned the idea of having the extended run from Winnipeg to Fort Frances. It just wasn't working out. There's less trains. But, you know, if you think there's many trains here, you ought to see the stuff going to the States. Like, you know, the main line for CN and everything else is, I bet you, twice what the CPR has. And with the way down to Chicago and everything else. And now the problem that I can see too in the future is these trains, like, I mean, you can run them from Seattle to New York City for about $30,000 less than you can from Vancouver to Toronto.
Because of
wages and,
no wages.
You know, everything else. And so fuel costs.
Yeah, those are tough realities for the negotiators on the Canadian side.
Yeah, and like someday they might decide to go down there.
Yep.
And the other thing is, you know, like, I mean, political aspect is, like, if you are in the greater port of Tacoma, which is Seattle,
yes,
and you ship 20% over what you shipped last year, you get a 15% cut on your property tax. And if you ship 80% more, you don't pay property tax.
This is what, to the state?
Yeah. You know, and so they go by the fact that you're going to be employing that many more employees.
Yes.
And the ones you have will be improving their houses, and they're going to make all that money.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Another view of that, of course, would be that it's sort of discriminatory, unless this is an attempt to impose that kind of tax regime on every other municipality across the country.
One-way street when you come to the arbitrator, even if you win, you don't. I mean, the softwood lumber industry has proved that. Yeah.
No unfairness in trade and in the continental economy seems to be essential to it. Well, what are your most vivid memories? We could talk a lot about things.
But, you know, another change that's happening now is the local college is running that course for training student brakemen. And
the one that's just starting now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing is that Medwit that's running it, he's from the CPR, the guy leaves a trail of slime behind him. He really is not an upright guy.
Maybe we should not pursue this too far. 4 years.
Okay, I'll start up again. Good.
Well, I suppose as we move towards the conclusion, what are your most vivid memories? Do you want to leave anything on the record in terms of vivid memories about the work that you've done?
I think, you know, becoming an engineer, that was quite an accomplishment for me. And going in the legislative side and helping one guy get his job back. And
you
better than getting his job back, we got his life back. He had really slipped into bad ways, and, you know, drugs were pretty common and everything else, and we actually had them enter programs, and we had a specialist from Toronto that helped quite a bit, and he got his job back and his life back.
Yeah, it would be very satisfying.
It is.
It's one thing to run a train through efficiently and be able to do that time after time, but to turn someone's life around.
But we didn't even think we could get his job back, but we would have been happy just getting his life back.
Sure. But you managed the job as well.
Yeah. So, and I learned a lot, too, about alcoholism.
I dare say.
It was pretty common there. I learned that an alcoholic, if you ask him how much he has to drink, he'll look you in the eye and say, well, I had 3 or 4 beer. You might have had a case.
Yeah.
But he is being honest that he, as far as he knows, he only had 3 or 4.
Remembers. He just remembers the first 3, does he?
Well, not necessarily remember. He just doesn't realize how much he drinks.
Yeah. And it is, of course, the drug of choice for most people.
For the railway, it was. It has changed now. Civilization. It's the railway employee, not so much here, but you go up into Gillam and that, where it's isolated. Too much money, nowhere to spend it, trouble.
Yeah.
Scriber's the same way. Scriber has, and at least before with, you know, I hate to say this, but with alcoholics, you know that they're drunk. You know, so you know that they're impaired, and a lot of times
compensate for that.
Well, lots of times when you had the bigger crews, you'd tell them, you know, like you go up in the cab and you stay there for the shift, and then when the shift was over, you'd read the Bloody Riot Act to them and say, you know, you're risking all our jobs.
Yeah.
Not just yours, and you're risking your life, and maybe our lives too.
Sure.
And we're not going to put up with this. But now with drugs and everything, the guy can be looped right out of his mind, and you don't even realize it.
No.
So that's a problem, but I think that's a problem in all industry.
It's probably a general problem in society.
Yeah, and the worst part is I see people starting to think that that's acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, like we're going downhill.
Yeah, that becomes very concerning.
Yeah.
If that attitude takes hold, no doubt about it. Yeah. Let me, in wrapping it up, ask you what your thoughts are about the project that we're carrying out, talking to people who've been involved with the grain trade over the years. Do you think it's important to preserve memories of this work?
It's important to preserve our history. You know, like a lot of people are going to look at those elevators and say they're eyesores.
Yes, you know, I dare say.
A lot of people have given their lives to those elevators, like for 35, 40 years of work. And,
right.
You know, and they're proud of it.
Sure.
But
we've talked to a few of them, but we need to talk to more of them.
Yeah, it's different times.
Yeah, they certainly are.
And, you know, the sad part is, it'd be better times, I think, if they were working.
I certainly think so.
You know?
I share that sentiment quite heartily.
Yeah. I mean, it's given a kick in Thunder Bay. Like, I mean, it's odd to say, but the only thing that's actually growing is a little bit of Bombardier or whatever name they're running under today, and the university and the college. Yeah.
Lots of retail trade, but the box stores and all the rest of it. You sometimes wonder where the income is that keeps them going.
But welcome to McDonald's, sir. May I take your order?
Yes, yes, quite. Are there any questions that we might have put to you, John, that you might still want to pose yourself an answer?
No, I don't think so. I think
we've done a good job of
scanning
the
activity. You've picked my brain. Not that it took a lot, but on the
contrary,
not much to pick. I mean, you know, I could tell story after story after story.
You clearly could.
But
Mr. Todrash to shame.
Oh no, I can't hold a. You know, like Harry Todrash says to me. He says, you know, he's got 3 daughters, eh? And the one's about 20 now, but she was about 16, the oldest daughter, and then he had one that was about 15 and one that was 12. And he says to me, you know, he says, I keep thinking, I came up to my wife's place. I had a leather jacket. I had hair down in my arsehole. He says, I'm driving a van with a bedroom in the back. And he actually let me go out with his daughter. And now I'm facing that, and I'm thinking, there is no damn way that I'm ever going to let a guy like that go out with my daughter.
Yeah, perspectives change, yeah, all right. Yeah. Don't
say
that.
My daughter to grow up.
Just the way he said the story, like, I mean, what a...
Yeah.
Yeah. He's...
Okay, well, John, it's been very, very interesting, and I think I'm feeling a bit dopey, without doubt, because of this head cold, but I kept having this feeling that if I were sharper and fresher, I would be pushing you into even more corners of your memory, your knowledge of the trade, because there's a great deal that you've told us and of all sorts of things. It's been.
But you know, the worst part is the only time you see the older railroaders is at a funeral.
Well, that is very, very sad indeed.
That's sad.
And the great opportunity that we have is talking to guys who've worked. Did you know Roy Lamour, or do you know
Gopher? Yes, I knew Gopher when he thought he could referee.
He was the first one we interviewed. And,
Roy tells good stories, too. He would have lots of stories.
Oh, he did indeed, including some vivid stories of accidents, of course, in the yards and so on and so forth. But
some of them took place right in front of the window he was at.
Yeah, they certainly did. Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, he was front row and center on a few.
Well, thanks very much, John. We'll wrap it up. If you have any memorabilia that you would want to pass on, but you're still working, so...